Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, a special and unforgettable feature made by Aviva Ziegler. It's an incredible tale of mostly young women who come down with a mysterious, life-threatening disease, often end up in psychiatric hospitals mislabeled, or in intensive care units with bizarre behaviour and metabolic meltdown, when simple surgery can be curative. Here's the story.
I was having hallucinations and there were voices in my head that were telling me to get the knives and to hurt people.
Her heart stopped 3 or 4 times and she stopped breathing.
They decided to have her have electronic shock treatment.
They were all young women. 2 of them were actually diagnosed with having an acute psychosis.
You always think the worst, and it was the worst.
When they were talking to me, it sounded like they were speaking in a different language.
She was having nightmares. Whenever she closed her eyes, things jumped at her.
She'd said to us, "Nicole doesn't belong in the psychotic ward and you need to get her out of here."
These cases were very much alike, but we were still unclear exactly what the condition was. We were flying by the seat of our pants, so to speak.
Saturday morning came and Nicole started to do some weird things, like get up off her bed, come down into the lounge room, say something to us, then just repeat the whole thing again. It was just frightening.
Before she started behaving very strangely, Nicole Costello had been a normal, healthy 21-year-old. Her mother, Marina, was completely bewildered.
Nicole's very fit, plays netball, coaches, umpires, she's on the netball committee. She wasn't herself.
As Nicole's behaviour became more and more erratic, the family rushed her to a nearby hospital. She was admitted to the psychiatric ward.
She was even more agitated, more aggressive. They started running a few tests. They all came back normal. And then she started shouting and yelling that she didn't want to be on the bed and trying to get off. And the nurses and myself, we were holding her down. She was really getting very agitated. And they said to me, "She's showing signs of being psychotic."
Her symptoms, at least on the surface, did appear to be psychiatric. And the doctors, convinced they knew what was wrong, went for a treatment that was pretty extreme.
They decided to have electronic shock treatment. You'd try anything thinking if that works, but it didn't work. One of the nurses there saw Nicole. She was just lying in her bed at this stage, not doing anything. She'd even stopped eating, and she'd said to us that Nicole doesn't belong in the psychotic ward. There's more to her problem, and you need to get her out of here. So this nurse called a code blue.
A code blue is an emergency call. It was a daring and deliberate step for the nurse to take, but it worked. When all hell broke loose, they moved Nicole to the intensive care unit. But things didn't improve.
They didn't know what to do with her. She was probably there for another week or so, and then they called the retrieval team from the Royal Adelaide Hospital, took her over there to the ICU unit. The doctors over there read all of Nicole's notes and decided to put her into like an induced coma. So we were told to say goodbye while she was still in and out of consciousness. In the meantime, they were still doing lots of tests. They were just trying everything and anything, but just still couldn't work it out.
Dr. Tim Kleinig, a neurologist, was one of the medical team trying to work out what was wrong with Nicole. They did every test they could think of.
First of all, a CT scan, which didn't show anything in it. We did an MRI scan as well. That didn't show anything either. And so we did a lumbar puncture where we take some fluid out from around the brain. And that was our first clue, really, as to what the underlying cause might be, because that did show that there was inflammation around the brain. And we sent off every conceivable immune test that we had at our disposal, as well as every infective antibody test. After all of those antibody tests came back negative, we suspected that it might be an immune encephalitis.
But suspecting a brain inflammation caused by an attack by Nicole's own immune system didn't help them understand the cause. The weeks slipped by and Nicole remained very sick and in a coma. All her anxious family could do was be there for her.
sort of life stopped because we were going to the hospital every single day. I stopped working. We all took it in turn so that Nicole was never ever alone. We thought that someone had to be there with her all the time. Even if she didn't know that we were there, we knew that we were there supporting her and just talking to her about anything and everything.
In desperation, the doctors began steroids in the hope of countering the immune attack on the brain, the encephalitis.
The first course didn't really do anything to Nicole, and then they gave her another stronger course of steroids. Then we started to see little changes in Nicole. Eyes opening, hands moving, just a few little twitches, and she still wasn't speaking or anything like that.
But still no diagnosis.
No diagnosis at all.
Nicole's condition was still a mystery when another case turned up. This time it was a mother of three from the country, Ros Brooker. Eerily, her symptoms mirrored Nicole's.
I was a bit confused, going in and out of thinking clearly. Wasn't sure where I was. I was having a lot of trouble sleeping. My mind was racing and couldn't settle down, and I'd never experienced anything like it before. I said to my husband, I just feel really strange. After that, it's all very hazy.
Worried about what was happening, Ros went to her GP. He referred her to a psychiatrist. But soon Ros began behaving even more strangely.
I was having hallucinations, and there were voices in my head that were telling me to get the knives and to hurt people.
By now, Ros's husband Steve was really frightened. With the psychiatrist's appointment still a week away, they rushed to the local hospital. Like Nicole, Ros too was sent to the psychiatric ward.
And while we're sitting in the waiting room, saying to Steve, why am I here? Why have you brought me here? I was really becoming really aggressive. When they were talking to me, it sounded like they were speaking in a different language. I pulled a plug out of one of the sinks and it had like a little spike, and I tried to use it to hurt myself. I was only here in the local hospital for a couple of days before they decided to send me down to Adelaide, and I was admitted to the intensive care unit at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, and Dr. Kleinig took over my case.
So now neurologist Tim Kleinig had his second case of a dangerous unknown condition with virtually the same symptoms.
And at that stage, she was essentially mute. She couldn't speak at all. She didn't make any spontaneous movements except for these bizarre rhythmic movements, and she was intubated. She was having the machine breathe for her. And apart from the bizarre movements, we couldn't get any response from her at all. Deep down inside her brain, she was awake but completely disconnected from the outside world.
Tests showed that Ros also had an inflammation of the brain. So having had some success with steroids on Nicole, Tim, still shooting in the dark, gave them to Ros as well.
The next day, we saw some responses that we had not seen for the previous weeks. So that gave us, again, a great encouragement that we were on the right track. We were working this condition out, flying by the seat of our pants, so to speak.
Ros began making little improvements, but the specialists had many and often conflicting opinions about what to do. When she was given an anti-epileptic drug, it had serious repercussions.
My liver failed, and then they rang Steve to get the family together and come straight down because they didn't think I was going to make it through the night. The next morning, it had rectified itself, and I was back in intensive care. Steve said it was 3.5 months that I was in the coma.
While searching for an answer to this agonising mystery, Tim Kleinig heard of another case, a young woman who'd been in the hospital about 8 years before. Intrigued, he began digging into her records.
These cases were very much alike, but unlike anything that we'd really read in the literature. But we were still unclear exactly what the condition was.
But what the Australian doctors didn't know was that they weren't alone. On the other side of the world, more cases were appearing with virtually the same mysterious symptoms. 18-year-old Annalisa Meyer had just begun her first day at Columbia University in New York when she contacted her mother, Pilar, with disturbing news.
Got an email saying that she was having nightmares whenever she closed her eyes, then things jumped at her, and she was afraid of that. that really got me very worried in that whatever was happening was not normal. At the time, I was in Belize in a business trip. So she called me to let me know how her first day of classes went and couldn't understand what she was saying. She was slurring her words. And then I heard the phone drop. I called her again and then I waited about 15 minutes after. She called me and she said that she was on the floor.
Pilar, talking to her on the phone, guided Annalisa to a medical center where she finally found some help.
Then she called me back and she said, they're taking me to the emergency room because they think that I either had a seizure or maybe I just fainted. You always think the worst, and it was the worst.
Fortunately, Annalisa's father, Dwight, was nearby and rushed to the hospital.
They did all kinds of tests at that point. While she was there, she had a seizure, so the doctor immediately moved her to ICU. And from there on, things went downhill. She started scratching her face and pulling her hair. And Dwight told me that he saw her, how she started deteriorating.
A day and a half later, when Pilar arrived in New York, Annalisa was even worse.
At times when she was conscious of who we were, she hugged me and she said, I knew you would come. And then she kind of lost it. She became violent and she wanted to leave. She wanted to get out. Dwight and I had to struggle to keep her in bed, and then they had to sedate her and they started doing different tests.
This is all sounding extremely familiar. It was very similar to the Australian women.
The one thing they thought that was important to do an MRI, they told us that it showed a mass that could be a tumor, and then it turned out to be a false alarm. The MRI showed that she had an encephalitis. It was like a ball of fire. It was the entire brain. So they said, we're going to have to do a very aggressive treatments to control the fevers. And they brought in all the experts in case she had any viruses or bacteria. The infection diseases doctor did not find anything. They thought it was meningitis, but then they ruled it out. When they ruled out every possibility, they started treating her for everything. She couldn't breathe, so they had to intubate her. I think at that point, we were wondering if she was in the right place, and they admitted that they did not have any answers. Annalisa started then moving her shoulders up and down, and she started making some movements with her mouth that was like kind of chewing, and she was actually chewing the tubes. They were very puzzled.
At the University of Pennsylvania, the then professor of neurology, Joseph Dalmau, had also been puzzled by this strange pattern in a number of patients he was seeing.
And all of them were very, very similar. Very young women that after an acute psychiatric period of symptoms develop all these manifestations, had to be in the ICU, and they had all these abnormal movements, the decreased level of consciousness, and spinal fluid that showing there was an inflammatory process in the brain. Many times the hallucinations are related to hyper-religiosity. People see angels, or they feel that God is talking to them directly, or they feel like they have possession of the absolute truth. There are patients, and this depends on religious background, the patient having the impression of being possessed, even ask the family members to call a priest or the equivalent, depending on the religion, to try to help them because they are hearing all these voices, having all these visions and hallucinations. The speech disintegrates. They start mumbling or repeating things. And then they have all these abnormal movements and contortions with the body or with the neck or with the face. When you put all together, it's a very scary situation.
Professor Dalmau began to study the strange condition.
The beginning was seeing a patient probably about 8 years ago that we didn't know exactly what the patient had. Before arriving to the intensive care unit, she had lots of psychiatric symptoms, then progressive deterioration of the level of consciousness, abnormal movements. So we had this patient in the intensive care unit for at least 8-10 weeks with all the tests imaginable done and negative, but we knew that the patient had an inflammation of the brain, and we suspected that this could be an immunological type of disorder. So we kept a small amount of blood of the patient, spinal fluid, and eventually these samples were analyzed, and after several months of work, we identified that there were antibodies. A few months later, we identified the target of the antibodies, that was the NMDA receptor.
So Tim Kleinig in Adelaide was right. There was an immune attack on the brain, but not the whole brain. Dalmau's work showed that it was exquisitely targeted on a chemical messenger called the NMDA, which explains the bizarre behaviour and the similar patterns. The symptoms arose because the immune attack was sending very specific abnormal messages into the brain.
But the clue that led to these studies is because after the first patient, I remember similar patients that had been seen over the years and nobody knew exactly the diagnosis. And all of them were very, very similar. Very young women that after an acute psychiatric period of symptoms developed all these manifestations, had to be in the ICU, and they had all these abnormal movements, the decreased level of consciousness, and spinal fluid that showing there was an inflammatory process in the brain. And what happens is that these initial four patients, all of them had a small tumor in the ovary that was a benign tumor that's called teratoma.
So now the story becomes even more bizarre. A teratoma is a weird tumour which is a relic of a person's life when they were an embryo. The teratoma is almost like a person within a person and can contain teeth, hair, and most significantly for many of these women, brain tissue.
When Professor Dalmau wrote his seminal paper on NMDA receptor encephalitis, or as the paper called it at that stage, ovarian teratoma associated encephalitis, I was struck by the similarities to our patients. A teratoma is an immature or primitive tissue, benign usually, but sometimes malignant tumour of the ovary or of the cells that form the eggs. And in all of these patients that have been described, all of the teratomas have had brain cells, and in particular brain cells which have expressed a particular sort of receptor, the NMDA receptor.
The body sees this tumor like a foreign type of tissue and mounts an attack, an immune response against these brain cells that are in the tumor, but the immunological system is tricked by these, and it not only goes against the tumor, but also is misdirected against the brain.
Professor Dalmau was making his discoveries in Philadelphia. In New York, Annalisa, the student at Columbia, was still undiagnosed and was moved to another hospital, New York Presbyterian, to their neurological intensive care unit. The move probably saved her.
The new doctor that saw her said, "I have not read her file. I have not seen very much of her, but I think I know what it is. The movements that she's making are very significant, and I've only seen them in other cases that are related to this very rare disease. I have very little literature. I know of, about 20 cases that have been reported. We understand that 2 out of 10 make it and 2 survive, and that's all I can say. I just couldn't believe that." The doctor said, "Are you ready to fight for Annalisa?" "Because I am." He said, "We're going to have to be very aggressive. We can do this together." And he said, "I lost one before. I'm not going to lose Annalisa."
Anxious for the quickest response possible, they appealed to Professor Dalmau for help.
So when the family and the physicians from the center in New York contacted me in Philadelphia, Annalisa was already in the intensive care unit, severely ill. She developed full-blown syndrome. And at that time, they contacted me. There were not too many patients described at the time. So we studied the spinal fluid and the serum, and we found she was positive for these antibodies. They identified that she had a tumor. She had a teratoma.
Further investigation revealed a second teratoma, and removal was highly recommended. Other patients had done well after the removal of theirs, but the gynecologists were resistant.
We had a little bit of a fight with the gynecology because they didn't want to remove the teratoma because they thought that maybe they needed to remove her ovary, and they did not have a reason to remove them because they were benign. if they took their teratomas out and they needed to take the ovaries, that as a young woman, that was not her choice. She needed to agree to something like that. Understanding that the removal of the teratomas could save her life, we said that that needed to be done. And they kept saying, well, what if she wants to get a family later in life? And I said, well, she can't have a family if she's dead. But at this point, the most important thing is to remove the teratomas.
And that's what happened. The teratomas went, and luckily, the ovaries could stay. But luck still wasn't on Annalisa's side.
And they were assuming that once they removed the teratomas, that she would wake up and the illness would go away, as it had been in some other cases. That was not her case. She did not wake up.
So how dangerous is this?
It is a very serious condition and has multiple stages. Even at the stage that the patients have psychiatric symptoms, probably around 80%, they can injure themselves. There are about 20% of patients, they are left with residual symptoms, and approximately 4% they die, mainly when they are in the intensive care unit.
Annalisa was in a coma for about 3 months, and she continued to have the symptoms. But Annalisa had somebody 24 hours a day, in the hope that whenever she opened her eyes, she would always have someone that loved her, someone that she would recognize. There was not one single day in which we could say things are normal. She had all kinds of infections, also pneumonia. Her heart stopped 3 or 4 times, and she stopped breathing a couple of times too. They had to do chemotherapy, and after they did the 4th treatment, they told us they couldn't do anything else for her anymore.
For the Mayer family, it was a terrifying waiting game. All they could do was hope that Annalisa would pull through. In Australia, Tim Kleinig's 2 patients were recovering well, even before he knew anything about Dr. Dalmo's discovery.
Then it made us think again about how well we had excluded teratoma in these patients. Mrs. Brooker was actually still in rehabilitation at the time when the paper came out, and I organised a CT scan for her, and lo and behold, we found a teratoma.
I had to go back to Adelaide every 3 months for a check-up. And the first time we went down and saw Dr. Kleine was when they found the teratoma on my ovary.
So what did they do?
They removed it in my tube as well. When the doctors explained to me that it could have been the thing that caused all the problems, I just wanted to get rid of it, hopefully. You know, that would be the end of it.
And then I organised to see Nicole Costello, our other patient, and we got her to bring along the CT scan that she'd had, and that had been reported as showing no teratoma, but on review of the scan, the teratoma was there.
Nicole Costello.
They said I didn't have to have it removed, but they did recommend that it was probably the best thing to do. It just shocked me because I sort of thought, how could something like that cause what Nicole went through?
So what percentage would have the tumour?
If the patients are women older than 18 years, about 45-50%, if they are younger than 18 years, for example, between 14 and 18 years, then this drops to approximately 25-30%. Younger than 14 years, the presence of a tumour is very uncommon. Now, the disease can also affect men. Sometimes is the equivalent of the teratomas of the ovary in women. Men can have teratomas in the testes. This has been found in a few men with this disease.
Having found a teratoma in the 2 cases that I personally looked after with Natasha Gray, a case from a decade previously, we went back over her notes and looked for a teratoma. She was almost identical in her clinical features. Everything was thought of, a million tests were performed and nothing was found. And her father, I know, was desperate to try and find a cure, and he did a lot of reading and had lots of suggestions for the doctors as to things that might be tried. But she didn't receive immune therapy, and that's really, I think, the key. She became increasingly unresponsive with occasional periods of frenzied agitation, and her temperature rose to 42 degrees. We couldn't find a cause for her fever, and then she had a respiratory arrest and she couldn't be resuscitated.
Tim Kleinig also dug out her autopsy findings, and there it was. She too had had a teratoma.
It had been dismissed as incidental to her condition because 1-2% of the female population who come to autopsy may have this benign tumour.
But there is a large group of patients with the same disease in that the tumour is not present. The immunological response is the same, but for the patients without tumour, it's unclear what triggers the disease. It's like a mystery or an encephalitis of unknown cause.
Knowing the cause, at least in the majority of patients, is one thing, but the NMDA affects many brain functions, and the antibodies had wreaked havoc on a lot of things, especially memory.
The receptors are critical for memory, so a dysfunction of the receptors translates with very poor memory, usually short-term memory. They can remember from the long past, but they cannot form new memories.
Ros Brooker again.
When I first woke up in the hospital, I didn't recognise anybody. I didn't know, you know, who my children were. They'd come in and say, "Hello, Mum," and I'd say, "What's your name?" I can remember everything from beforehand. And then after that, I've got a few little vague memories from that year, but then I've got everything from after.
Luck was finally on Annalise's side, and she did recover. But like all of those who experience this disease, it was a lot of hard work to relearn all that had been forgotten.
She needed to learn how to breathe again on her own, to swallow, how to eat, and then and how to speak. The brain compensates, although it's a very slow process. She had forgotten everything, and yet how she started just remembering.
Annalisa has recently completed her first year at Columbia University and was delighted to achieve 2 A's. She still has a way to go, but she's undoubtedly back.
I am very grateful. Having her in front of me, finishing her first year at Columbia, was not even in my dreams at that point.
I feel like it never even happened. I don't have any memory of it. Because I was on a lot of steroids, I gained a lot of weight. But apart from that, I don't have any ongoing problems or anything.
Did you have hope that she would make a full recovery, or what were you thinking?
Well, the doctors said they didn't really know whether she would or wouldn't. It was really hard to think that she ever really would. It's taken a long time. And they said that she may get Parkinson's, I think it was disease, but time will tell. But she has made a full recovery, we think.
Sometimes I feel frustrated that I've lost that time. Going through something like that makes you realise that you've got to make the most of every day and you can't take things for granted. There's probably people that are in a lot worse situation than I am. Some people don't recover. I'm grateful that I did, and just hope that people in this position can look at what happened to me and have hope.
Like many of the affected families, Marina wrote a diary about the journey they took with Nicole.
There is still a lot of things I didn't write in there, frightening things that Nicole did and said, and I don't want to frighten her. They did a couple of write-ups on her while she was in hospital and things like that in the paper. She was reading them and she was saying to me, you know, "Did I really do that, Mum? Did I say that, Mum? And is that what happened to me?" And she just can't believe that she'd done those sort of things.
It must be very hard to fathom for you.
Yeah, because, you know, I haven't actually heard that whole story like that before. Sorry.
I wouldn't know what it would be like to have lost my memory for 6 months of, you know, of your life and not know what you've done.
It's very hard to know exactly how common it is because it's only so recently described, and I'm sure that there are still cases that are being missed.
We live in times that we think most of the diseases have already been described. What we don't know is the cause of many diseases. And actually, what is surprising is that this is not the case. And this is one of these diseases.
That special health report feature was made by Aviva Ziegler, and you can hear it again by going to Radio National's website. I'm Norman Swan. See you next time.